listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of things that are going on at the United Nations. First, from the spokesperson for the Secretary General, and then from the spokesperson for the President of the General Assembly. This is Stefan Dujarric, who is the spokesperson for the Secretary General of the UN.
All right. Good afternoon. Geir Pedersen started his duties today as Special Envoy for Syria, based in Geneva, as you know. In a tweet, he said that he was honored to assume his duties in service of the Syrian people and their aspirations for peace. He added that he looks forward to consulting broadly within and outside of Syria. As you know, Mr. Pedersen succeeds Staffan de Mistura. We've all greatly appreciated Mr. de Mistura's tireless efforts on behalf of the Syrian people. As a mediator, Mr. de Mistura demonstrated many times his ability to bring together the international community as he tried to bring peace to the country. Meanwhile, we strongly condemn the abduction and killing of a humanitarian aid worker in Syria, Mark Cutts, the deputy humanitarian coordinator for the country. Said today that he was appalled and outraged by the news of the abduction and killing of an aid worker representing a non-governmental organization last week in Idlib and in the northwest part of the country. Parties to the conflict have an obligation not only to protect their lives, but also to ensure that aid workers can work unhindered. And On Yemen, just to give you a logistical update, Martin Griffiths, the special envoy, is in Riyadh today, and he expects to meet President Hadi of Yemen tomorrow. And over the weekend, he was in Yemen, where he met with the Ansarallah leadership as well as with UN officials. And on the Central African Republic, our humanitarian colleagues said they were shocked and saddened by the killings of a humanitarian worker in Batafango in Uam Prefecture on Saturday. A guard of a non-governmental organization succumbed to injuries following following a shooting during a violent break-in at his organization's premises. The Central African Republic is one of the most dangerous places for humanitarian aid workers, according to the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Some 396 incidents directly affecting humanitarian personnel and assets, that's more than one incident per day, were recorded in 2018, and that was a 17.5% increase compared to to 2017. He also, and also in the Central African Republic, the government and the humanitarian country team, the UN's humanitarian country team, have today launched the 2019 Humanitarian Response Plan, which requests $437.7 million to assist 1.7 million extremely vulnerable people. The number of people in need of assistance and protection has increased from 2.5 million to 2.9 million, a 16% rise compared to 2018. Of these people, 1.9 million people require immediate assistance. More information online. And just to flag that over the weekend, we issued a statement on Burkina Faso in which the Secretary General said he was concerned over the deteriorating security situation in some parts of the country where the authorities declared a state of emergency. He's also concerned about intercommunal violence. And in Vienna, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime released a report that says the number of human trafficking victims is on the rise and calls on countries to strengthen their cooperation to protect victims and bring criminals to justice. The report found a clear increase in the number of children being trafficked and who now account for 30% of all detected victims, with far more girls detected than boys. Sexual exploitation continues to be the main purpose of trafficking, accounting for some 59%. The report draws on information from 142 countries and examines trafficking trends and patterns while focusing on human trafficking in armed conflict. More information on the UN Office of Drugs and Crimes website. And at 4:35 p.m. This afternoon, Sandra Erika Yovel Polanco, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Guatemala, will be here in this room to brief you on her meeting with the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. I pause and take questions.
Thank you, Stefan, and Happy New Year. There was reports yesterday about a young Saudi woman that was not allowed to enter Thailand and her passport confiscated by Saudi officials in Bangkok. And she was denied at the beginning access to UNHCR office to seek refuge. As far as I understand from the last hour, that UNHCR in Bangkok got in contact with her. My question is, and this is to the Secretary General, does he have any position one way or the other on a universal rights ground about the guardianship laws in Saudi Arabia and its impact on the rights of female Saudi citizens?
Look, on this particular case, UNHCR is involved, and as far as I understand from what we've been told, they're in touch with the young lady in person as a matter of principle for the world over. The Secretary General believes in equal treatment of men and women under the law. Mr. Bays, you may, but later on, 2020 maybe.
You just told us that the Foreign Minister of Guatemala is going to be here to give the readout of the meeting with the Secretary General. Can we ask what the Secretary General is likely to tell the Foreign Minister, particularly given this row over the corruption body, the UN-backed corruption body, and now one member of that body being held?
Well, you know, the meeting was requested by the Foreign Minister of Guatemala. So before I know what the Secretary General will say to the Foreign Minister, we obviously have to hear what the Foreign Minister has to say since she requested the meeting. As you know, the Secretary General has and continues to support the work of the Commission and expects the Guatemalan government to provide the Commission with all the assistance necessary for the discharge of its functions and activities, including the freedom of movement of its staff and throughout Guatemala, as provided in the agreement that was signed. Senor.
I also have a follow-up on Guatemala. There is a growing concern that after the incident over the weekend, other investigators with the commission who are still outside of Guatemala could go through the same that this investigator went through over the weekend. So I wonder if the SG shares that concern about what could happen to these other investigators who are outside of the country.
I'm not going to predict what will happen. We're obviously happy that Yelena Osorio was allowed back into the country, and we expect the Guatemalan government to allow all the staff of the commission freedom of movement, whether it is coming back into Guatemala or whether it is traveling throughout the country. I'm begging for questions here. I should have left, I sense. Go ahead.
I can provide.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Stefan. I'm getting reports in from Hodeida, from humanitarians there, of large numbers of civilians returning to the city. Apparently it's too cold in the hills around and they want to get back to their homes. Also, they feel that the ceasefire deal in Hodeida is holding. But there are concerns because there isn't actually peace in the city yet and they could be returning to a dangerous situation. Question, do you have any confirmation of these reports? Any idea of the number of peoples? And
no, I mean, we had in the past few days, if I recall, report on some movement of people back into Yemen. We very much hope that all the parties involved will respect the agreement. And obviously, Mr. Griffiths, his stay in Yemen, and now his trip to Saudi Arabia, where he meet with President Hadi, is a big part of reinforcing the work that was done in Stockholm.
I'm sorry, at the beginning there you said movement of people back into Yemen, but did you
back,
mean...
Back into Hodeida, yes, I did. Thank you for listening. James.
Yeah, just a follow-up on Yemen. Do we have any guidance now on when the special envoy hopes to convene the second round of talks? We were told it was going to be this month at some point, and we know that those are not going to be convened in Stockholm again. Some suggestions, maybe Kuwait or Jordan. Could you give us any...
No,
any
I think Mr. Griffiths is... neck deep, as one would say, into these things, and we will let him announce when he feels the time is right on the next steps for face-to-face discussions.
Thank you. I just wanted to see whether you had any thoughts to share with us on the ongoing election process in the DRC. As you know, there were some results expected over the weekend that were not forthcoming.
I always have thoughts to share on many things, but I'll skip the personal thoughts. We've obviously seen the decision taken by the Independent Electoral Commission to delay the announcement of the provisional results of the presidential elections. As you know, those were expected on Sunday. We look forward to the timely publication of the provisional results by the commission, and I think it bears reminding that all stakeholders in this process have a responsibility to respect the laws and regulations governing the electoral process, help maintain an environment free of violence so as to enable the peaceful conclusion of the presidential, national, and provincial legislative elections in a manner that reflects the will of the Congolese people. Carol, I will come back to you.
Stefan, there were reports of an attempted coup in Gabon this morning, and I was wondering if the Secretary General had reached out to anyone, if the UN was doing anything.
Yes, the Secretary General and others have been fully briefed. His special representative for Central Africa, François Lonsenifal, is monitoring the events closely, and he stands ready to provide good offices if and as required. Of course, as a principle, the Secretary General has always stood against unconstitutional changes of power, especially by force, and in that light, he condemns the attempted coup that took place this morning in Gabon. And the Secretary General does take note that calm appears to have returned to Libreville and calls on all actors to follow the constitutional means. Yeah, go ahead, Carol, then we'll come back.
Sorry, I'm on another.
Oh, okay.
Also reports on Myanmar that the army has launched a new operation in Rakhine.
Where we've seen the press reports, we're trying to get a bit more information from our end. Yes.
Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Representative for Human Rights, said a couple of days that the trials in Saudi Arabia with the accused of assassinating Jamal Khashoggi falls short of international standards, and she's calling that an international probe must be taking place. Did the Secretary General receive any formal request from Turkey or any other party to conclude that? And is there any intention to activate Article 99 and bring it to the attention of the Security Council, since there was a violation of the Vienna Convention?
There's been no official request and nothing further to add on that.
Last question. When the Secretary General is going to have his press conference, the New Year press conference? That's the easy one.
Yeah, it's. I'm trying to picture the calendar in my head. I think somewhere between the 16th and the 18th of January.
Thank you.
In this very room. Monica, welcome.
That was Stefan Dujarric, the spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, speaking at the United Nations in New York on Monday. This is the spokesperson for the President of the UN General Assembly, Monica Grayley, at her press conference also on Monday at the UN in New York.
Thank you very much, Steph, and Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year, actually, to all of you here. It's nice to see you again for this new year. So, good afternoon. I just wanted to say that we had my colleague, Mark Seddon, who is sitting in the back there, and I, we had a meeting with the PGA, and I would like to convey on her behalf her thank you to all of you for the cooperation last year. So she's looking forward to a strong cooperation this year, working a relationship with you. As you know, she said before repeatedly that the role of the media is a very important one, a very crucial one in her agenda. And then, again, thank you very much for all your work. Excellent work last year, and we look forward to continuing this work with you this year. And by the way, a very busy year, as I said before. I'm going to start with an informal plenary meeting that the PGA will convene on to brief, actually, member states. This is going to happen on the 15th of January at 3 p.m. at the Trusteeship Council Chamber. So this is an informal meeting where she will discuss, of course, her agenda for the coming months. And also, on another event for these coming months, the PGA will preside over a high-level debate on international migration and development on the 27th of February 2019 in the ECOSOC Chamber. This meeting is mandated by the GA, as you may have heard, and we will be organized under the auspices of the president of the GA in the of the 2019 high-level dialogue. The meeting will serve to inform the high-level political forum on sustainable development, which will review the goals and targets relevant to migration of the 2030 agenda for sustainable development, taking into consideration the outcomes of other processes related to international migration and development. And the date is the 27th of February. And also, you may recall that the president has appointed the ambassadors of Spain, His Excellency Agustin Santor Maraver, and of Bangladesh, His Excellency Masood bin Momen, as co-facilitators for the Migration Review Forum. So this, or both of them, will lead open, transparent, and inclusive consultations with member states to determine the modalities and organizational aspects of the International Migration Review. And then this is requested actually by the Global Compact itself, and the modalities shall be finalized by 31st of July. And on the Convention of the Rights of the Child, the GA will also commemorate the 30th anniversary of the convention this year by organizing a high-level plenary meeting of the 74th session of the GA, the General Assembly, to help with consultations with member states, but also on the organization and procedural arrangements. So, Ms. Maria Fernandez Espinosa, for that,
ago, appointed His Excellency Mr. Georgi Velikov Panayotov, Ambassador of Bulgaria, and also Her Excellency Maliha Lodi, who is the Ambassador of Pakistan to the UN. They will also co-facilitate an open and transparent consultative process with member states to finalize the modalities resolution for this high-level plenary meeting. And today, on the PGA's agenda, President Espinosa will have a bilateral meeting this afternoon with the ambassador of Belgium. She will also grant two interviews, one to the Washington Times and also later Bloomberg TV. And this is also everything that we have here from us today. Do you have any questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Monica, and welcome back. Again, on the Saudi woman in Thailand, my question, does the PGA, who have been a longstanding advocate for women's rights, have any position on the guardianship laws in Saudi Arabia that prevents women from taking basic decisions regarding their free will? If I may put it this way.
You are absolutely spot on. Gender equality is actually the first priority of this PGA. She, as we said before, has been advocating for human rights and also for gender equality a long way before that became trendy, according to some analysts, and she's very consistent about that. On this particular issue that you are mentioning, she took notes through the media reports that we all have seen, and also recalls that UNHCR is now in the scene there. So we are following this report. But thank you.
What about the guardianship laws in Saudi Arabia?
Look, the PGA, as I said before, has been very consistent on gender equality. This is number one priority of her presidency. And it's certainly an important topic for the PGA. It's first priority out of seven. And that's what we have to say about that. But thank you for your question. Yes, go ahead.
I didn't understand what you had to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
Does she condemn the guardianship laws in Saudi Arabia, given her very important priority that she makes her first priority of gender equality? Does she believe those laws are acceptable in the modern day age?
The PGA is a strong advocate for gender equality. This is her first priority. I don't have anything to say on this particular issue.
But, with the greatest respect, mm-hmm. if it's such a priority, then why can't she speak out about appalling instances where gender equality is not in place, like the guardianship rules of Saudi Arabia? It seems a little mealy-mouthed to one minute say it's your key priority and then not be able to say something about one of the countries that is not applying any gender equality.
James, thank you very much for your question, also for your question on this. As I said before, on this particular issue, I don't have anything else to say apart from what I've said before. So if there is a request for the PGA to comment on this, I can get back to you. But I think this is a very clear that gender equality is important, that women and men are equal, and they have their rights as human beings, and that's what we have to say on this.
Can I just have a follow-up?
Yes, of course.
On that. As the female president of the General Assembly, is she not concerned that the women in Saudi Arabia would be notified by text messages when they are divorced? Is she concerned or not about that?
You are talking about a particular issue from laws from a particular country. And as we said before from this podium, when we were asked about legislations and decisions about particular countries, that we are not commenting on specific issues. I think it's very telling that this is the first female president from Latin America. It is very telling that she has been advocating for her priorities as number one, gender equality. But on this specific case, that, as we all know, started surfacing on the media landscape yesterday, I don't have any further comments. But I acknowledge your question, and I thank you for your question. And as I said before, there is a request for a personal comment, and I will take it on board. But thank you. Welcome back, and Happy New Year. Okay, any other questions? No? Okay, so I'll see you tomorrow, and thank you very much. Thank you.
National Security Advisor John Bolton was in Israel on Sunday, and he held a press conference with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem.
Good evening. It's a real pleasure for me to welcome to the Prime Minister's residence here in Jerusalem someone who I've known and respected for well over two decades, America's National Security Advisor, John Bolton. John, your visit to Israel gives us an opportunity to do two things. First, it gives us an opportunity to thank the Trump administration for the extraordinary support you've shown Israel. The president walked away from the dangerous Iran deal and reimposed sanctions. That's number one. That's important to America, to Israel, to the world. And everybody who wants to stop Iranian aggression respects that deeply. Secondly, the president decided to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the embassy here, a historic decision, which we welcome. And we welcome, every time I see Ambassador Friedman here, I said, well, it's a short ride at least. So we welcome him along with your entire delegation. Third, you've unequivocally backed Israel at the United Nations, and that's something that, again, is deeply appreciated by all Israelis and all friends of Israel around the world. And you have backed, both in word and deed, Israel's right to defend itself, which we exercise constantly. It's important to know that we have the backing of our great friend and ally, the United States of America. Tomorrow, if weather permits, we'll go up to the Golan Heights. Again, depending on the weather, the Golan Heights is tremendously important for our security. And I think that when you're there, you'll be able to understand perfectly why we'll never leave the Golan Heights and why it's important for that all countries recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. I've discussed this with the president, and I hope I have a chance to show it directly to you tomorrow on our visit. And if we can't fly there, I'll say it again to you. I want to welcome you and your delegation to thank you once again for your extraordinary support. Welcome, friend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Prime Minister, thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here again in Jerusalem. Great to see you again. Jerusalem is such a fascinating city, such a historic city, and is now known among its other attributes as the home of the American Embassy to Israel, as you said. What a remarkable achievement that you and President Trump worked out to actually bring the embassy to the capital of Israel. It was one of President Trump's campaign promises, and he was determined to make it a reality and work so closely with you to achieve it. I think, in fact, Prime Minister, under your leadership with President Trump, we now have the best U.S.-Israel relationship in our history. On our side, we're certainly determined to continue that, because the leadership that's necessary in what is increasingly, I think, a very critical time for security here in the Middle East and for us around the world requires that strong bond and strong leadership that you and the President provide. We've got the continuing threat of Iran's quest for deliverable nuclear weapons. And despite getting out of the Iran nuclear deal, despite the sanctions, we have little doubt that Iran's leadership is still strategically committed to achieving deliverable nuclear weapons. The United States and Israel are strategically committed to making sure that doesn't happen. And right on your border, we have the problem of the conflict in Syria. We're going to be discussing the president's decision to withdraw, but to do so from northeast Syria in a way that makes sure that ISIS is defeated and is not able to revive itself and become a threat again, and to make sure that the defense of Israel and our other friends in the region is absolutely assured, and to take care of those who have fought with us against ISIS and other terrorist groups. You know, it's for the United States, a sovereign nation's ability to defend itself is the ultimate mark of sovereignty. And President Trump has said repeatedly that he backs Israel's right to self-defense. He says it proudly and unequivocally. And I would just say to any nation, whether in this region or not in this region, that has any doubt about America's support for Israel's self-defense, they better think about it again. So, Prime Minister, I'm really grateful for you and all of your team's time today and the discussions we've had. They've been very wide-ranging. I think helped strengthen the relationship that you and President Trump have and our two nations have. And it's just a delight to be here again.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. It is often said that the United Nations is only as good as its member states allow it to be. But what happens when those member states deliberately start to act up? Can the institution itself, its legacy, the synergies it creates, prove that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Secretary General, first of all, let me welcome you here in Moscow. It's great
it's
to see
pleasure.
You. Thank you very much for your time. Let me start with congratulating you on Portugal's victory over Morocco on Wednesday. Did you have a chance to watch the game?
Yes, I watched the game, and let's be clear. I mean, we won the game, but we didn't play very well.
Exactly, and that way you're leading me to my next question, because according to that game stats, the Moroccans were better across the board in terms of the possession of the ball, in terms of the shots on target, etc., but they still lost. And I wonder if... You often see this kind of dynamic at the United Nations when a country puts up a good game, but the final score is still not in its favor.
Well, it happens all the time, not only everywhere. I mean, I remember in football in the past, we sometimes had very good teams and we would lose the games and say we won morally. I think yesterday we have lost morally. But what matters is now, not in football, but in the context of international relations, what is essential is for countries to be able to come together and to face the global challenges we have today that are dramatic challenges, understanding that we cannot do it alone. We need multilateral organizations, and we need multilateral governance, and we need international cooperation.
Speaking of which, the biggest, most influential player in the UN is still the United States, which just recently withdrew from the UN Human Rights Council. I understand that the optics of it are not very positive, but in actual terms, what kind of a fallout do you expect from that?
Well, of course, I would strongly prefer, and I said since the first moment, that the United States would stay in the Human Rights Council. I believe the human rights architecture is a very important element in the UN. Human rights is one of the pillars of the United Nations. And I hope that sooner or later, sooner rather than later, the U.S. will be able to come back. As I said, I strongly believe that in today's world, we need multilateral responses.
The Americans cited both criticism and bias as the reasons for their walkout, and the United Nations Security Council certainly is not the only body to criticize either Israel or the United States, for that matter. I wonder if you have any concerns at all whether that kind of precedent could be repeated and if the United States can pull out from the United Nations altogether.
I don't
think
so. Is that possible? I mean, let's be clear. The United States plays a very important role in the UN. The United States is a founding member, like the Russian
and
Federation.
And it used to care a lot about
permanent members
and
of the Security Council. And, of course, one thing is to be out of one or two areas that are more, I would say, peripheric. The other thing is to be, of course, involved in the center of the activities of the UN. And I believe this will go on. More, I'm a true believer that when one looks at the United States and the Russian Federation, those two countries have in many aspects common interests. Sometimes they are fighting, but they have common interests. And if one look at the Middle East, that is the area that we have been, that was mentioned about this decision, the global Middle East is an area where I strongly believe that the geostrategic interests of the United States and the Russian Federation are not antagonic. On the contrary, I think the geostrategic interests are similar, and I strongly hope that the divisions that have existed in the two countries will be overcome, and that the two countries will be able to have a strong cooperation, allowing the international system to work. There is no way in which an international system like ours can work without a solid cooperation between the two most important superpowers.
Let me ask specifically about the reasons cited for the American walkout. These allegations of bias are certainly not new. I'm sure you've heard Russia, China, Syria, many other countries make similar claims after unfavorable votes, but none of them ever walked out of the council simply because I think most of them realize that they are not limited to one single issue. The value of the council is broader. Do you take this American withdrawal to mean that the United States at this moment of time doesn't care about anything else but Israel?
Now, look, in relation to the Human Rights Council, the U.S. position has not always been the same. The U.S. was out, then it came in, now it's going out again, which means that there is a balance in the American public opinion and in the American institutions, depending on the party that
you call
is...
it balance or
insulation? No, the party that is in... that has shown different attitudes in relation to the Human Rights Council. So I don't think we should generalize this. I think this is a very specific area where we have always seen the U.S. With a, I would say, position in, position out, position in. So let's hope that in the future the U.S. will come back.
Now, speaking about the nature of that criticism, I know that the U.N. Envoy in Poverty, Philip Elston, has just submitted a report very critical of Trump's President Trump's tax overhaul, claiming that it overwhelmingly benefited the wealthy and worsened inequality. And I wonder if that is perhaps a little bit too personal. It's one thing to criticize any given country's track record, and another thing to, you know, bash individual presidents' policies before it was actually fully implemented.
Well, we have in the UN several things. You have the UN Secretariat. You have the different bodies, namely the Security Council, the General Assembly, Human Rights Council, and then you have special rapporteurs that act independently and that present their reports criticizing countries here and there on the most different issues, which of course do not necessarily represent the position of the UN in its entirety. My position on this has always been very clear. I think it is better to do it always taking the country into account, not personalizing things, and in the UN with a very strong concern in the UN Secretariat. We need to be impartial and we need not to politicize issues, to treat them based on the truth and based on the Charter of the United Nations.
But are you then suggesting that certain people within the UN went against your direct advice? Because if you let me to quote that report, it specifically pointed out that the policies pursued over the past year seemed deliberately designed to remove basic protections from the poorest. It seems like a fairly targeted shot,
but
especially...
But as I said, this is a report by a special rapporteur that is independent. It's an opinion that, of course, needs to be taken into account, considered, but doesn't represent the position, the formal position of the UN.
But... you know, those are very delicate issues because I'm sure you would agree with me that the position of the American president, of President Trump, at this point of time, his actions are crucial for the future of your organization. And he's known as somebody who is very sensitive and sometimes very reactive to the criticism. Do you think that kind of statements are wise in the current environment?
I don't think it will be the reason for any crisis. As I said, in my way of doing things, different people do things in different ways. My way to do things and to do my job is not to personalize and to do things based on impartiality and the objective analysis of situations. But of course, people are different. And I think it's important when you have independent rapporteurs on this kind of issues to respect their independence. That doesn't mean that we subscribe what we say, but we respect that independence. Because if not, everybody then will be manipulated. And this, of course, would completely undermine the respectability of those independent bodies that are an important component of the international community. But of course, as I said, independent rapporteurs are one thing. The UN Secretariat is another.
Now, let me ask you about one more issue that's a lot in the news today that you yourself weighed in, and this is the Trump administration's immigration policy, particularly the practice of separating children from their parents who cross into the United States illegally. Mr. Trump has just sought to reverse that policy by his executive order, and I wonder whether you, as Secretary General, have really understood how this man functions. What can possibly persuade him to change his mind, as he just did on the immigration issue?
I don't think we should personalize things. I think we need to look at policies as policies exist.
But he's quite a big personality with lots of impact.
What I did when that policy was published was to say that, in my opinion, that is not a good thing. And my experience as High Commissioner for Refugees is always that to separate families is something that can have very negative consequences for the people and then, of course, for the society in general. And I'm glad that the policy will be reversed. And I've seen that many other actors in the international community and in the U.S. politics, including in the family, have expressed their opinion. As I said, the best way to be active, in my opinion, is not to personalize, is to look into things objectively. And if we do it in a way that is impartial, if we do it in a way that is objective, I think that's the best way to convince people to do the right thing.
Well, let's try to look at it impartially. Trump's policies are usually couched in moral terms, but I think there is a very real legal dilemma there. It is not good in any way to separate children from their parents, but I think you would also agree that the United States is entitled and has the right to prosecute people who cross into its territory illegally. So I wonder whether a more humane way would be to put those children in jail together with their parents, or perhaps to grant those parents a waiver from prosecution simply because they happen to be parents.
Well, countries have the right to have their own migration policies, but migration policies need also to respect human rights. Migration policies in the management of borders need also to be protective sensitive, namely respecting international refugee law. I myself am against the criminalization of someone just because someone entered not legally in the country. You see, refugees have no other chance to escape but to cross a border not in a legal way. So I'm not in favor of a policy of hard criminalization. But as I said, I recognize countries have the right to define their own migration policies. What is important is that they do it in respect to human rights, to human dignity, because migrants are also human beings that need to be considered and respected.
Absolutely, and we would all do our best for our children, but I think I don't represent Fox News here, but I think it is important to recognize that we are not talking about, you know, Syrian mothers fleeing for their lives. We are talking about Mexican mothers and fathers who try to find a better future for their kids, but they are living a vibrant, developing country. So
I'm Portuguese. In the 60s, 1,500,000 Portuguese left that country, at the time walking into France. And they were basically moving because of poverty and basically because they wanted a better life. Now, it doesn't mean that I think everybody should do it, but I have a lot of respect for people that, in the case of the Mediterranean, put their lives at risk crossing the Mediterranean, with the aspiration to provide for their children a better life than the one they could have. So, again, I am totally against smuggling of people, but I have a deep respect for the people that try to do something to come out of... Look at Honduras, Salvador, and Guatemala. There is more people killed in these countries by the different gangs that operate than in the Syrian war. So we are in situations that are sometimes desperate, which means that in these flows of people, you have people that flee only because of economic reasons, but we have also people that have been victims of persecution. So again, countries have the right to define their policies. Countries have the right to send back migrants, but all that needs to be done in respect for the basic human rights and for the dignity of people.
Now, migration is obviously a very contentious issue, not only in the United States, but also in Europe, which used to be, as you just pointed out, more welcoming towards migrants and refugees.
Let me tell you something about migration. Okay. My mother is 94 years old. Portugal is not a very rich country, as you know. My mother is 94 years old. I visit my mother when I go back to Portugal every month, and she has always one person taking care of her, 24 hours by 24 hours, independent of the family. I've never seen a Portuguese taking care of my mother. And in most of the European countries, you have fertility indexes of 1.2, 1.3, 1.4. Migration is also necessary. What is needed, in my opinion, is to recognize that need and then to organize it with international, to avoid this illegal migration, to organize migration, to create opportunities for legal migration, taking into account the interests of states and the interests of people. We need to look at migration as a normal thing in which states need to have the responsibility to organize them properly instead of leaving to this desperate situation in which people flee because there is nothing in place to allow for normal flows that take into account the needs of countries of origin and the needs of countries of destination.
Well, Secretary General, I had a chance to interview you, I think it was 4 years ago, when you were UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and you said pretty much the same thing, that migration has to be managed and balanced. In the 4 years that have passed, do you think the countries have learned how to do it in a balanced way that you are
discussing?
No,
and that is the problem we have today. I think I was right 4 years ago, and I'm still right, and the fact that this is not being sincerely assumed is creating the chaotic situation that we see in many parts of the world, in which migration became the issue in many electoral campaigns. And because of that, you see populist countries, populist parties, xenophobic movements, and others gaining ground in many countries. If migration will be managed properly, in respect for the interests of the countries, but also for the interests of the people, I think this would not be the issue that is driving the politics in so many countries.
Now, one of the reasons why migration keeps on increasing, and we are now having record number of more than 68 million people being displaced globally. One reason
but those
for
are displaced by conflict or persecution.
By conflict. And you said recently that the number of those violent conflicts is now the highest in 30 years. The number of people killed in those conflicts has risen tenfold since 2005, which you said makes conflict prevention and mediation all the more important. And I would think that the United Nations is the most natural venue for that. Why is it not more successful in mediating all those trends?
Well, you know, normally when we are successful, nobody notices. But I'll just give you an example. But,
which means that here you're absolutely failing.
I'll just give you
failing.
An example. There was an election in Liberia. And the election in Liberia was contested, as you know, and there was a problem whether the results would be recognized or not. I've sent President Obasanjo, one of our members of our high-level panel of mediation that was there in the day, talking to the two candidates to make sure that they would accept the results and that there would not be a disturbance, as we have seen in many other parts, and if there was a problem, to go to the courts and whatever. We are now doing the same in mediation together with the African Union and the SADC in relation to Madagascar. We have done the same in discreetly in Sierra Leone, which means there are lots of activity. We are mediating at the present moment, doing our best to avoid a dramatic battle for the city of Hodeida.
But you would recognize that the failures are still glaring.
No, what it is difficult. And the reason is very simple. Power relations in the world became much less clear. I remember the Cold War, I remember a unipolar world. Now the world is kind of chaotic. It's moving, hopefully, into a multipolar world. And I'm a strong defender of the idea that the world should be organized in a multipolar way. But today we have a chaotic world. Impredictability, impunity is the name of the game. You see lots of vectors. I mean, how many armies are there now fighting inside Syria, for example? It's very difficult to mediate in these circumstances. But having said so, one reason more to make prevention the priority of priorities, to do everything to address root causes of conflict, to do everything to create the conditions for communities not to create the level of tension that leads them to conflict. But you are absolutely right. We are far from being successful because this world now It's a difficult world, a complex world, where we have a multiplicity of actors and a multiplicity of spoilers creating havoc in so many areas with enormous suffering of the people.
Well, Secretary General, let us take a very short break now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Secretary General, it's been about a year and a half since you took this position, and from the very beginning you were faced with this challenge of, I think, diminishing American presence both in financial terms and some would say moral terms, and I assume that led you to rely more on other actors, on other players. Has it worked out? Did other have other players step up their game in the light of American diminishing presence?
I'm a strong supporter, as I said, of a multipolar world. So I think we, independently of what the United States does, I think we need to be able to promote circumstances in which a multiplicity of actors assume a more and more relevant role within the UN.
You're also a realist, I think.
And the truth
right?
is that you see more and more countries being active in the context of the United Nations, and that is very much welcome from me, independently of the position of the United Nations, of the United States. I mean, fortunately, until now, the United States have, in relation to the key financial commitments of the UN, maintained their position. There are, as I said, as you said, some areas, I mean, peripheral areas where the U.S. has left, but in relation to the central aspects the U.S. has maintained. But independently of that, it's important to have a multiplicity of actors, and it is that equilibrium that allows for a U.N. to be more impartial and more effective.
Given how important the United States still is, both to the funding and the running of your organization. I'm sure as Secretary General, you had to run through several contingency plans. I wonder in your planning whether you see this changed posture of the United States as something temporary that may change 2 or let's say 6 years down the line, or is it a permanent change?
No, I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that we have been able to maintain with the U.S. a working relationship. The U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley has been extremely constructive in addressing the difficulties that we face sometimes.
Really, the latest statement
of
the
talking
UN
about
Human
relations,
Rights Council
talking about relations
also counts
with
like
the,
that?
Talking about relations with the Secretariat and the solution of the problems that might, of course, the United Nations have their own political positions on many issues. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the constructive relationship with the Secretariat. I think we have managed to have a constructive relationship and we want to keep it. But as I said, we need to have a world and the United Nations in which many actors act together, creating an environment of impartiality and equilibrium. To have the world or the United Nations or whatever only dependent on one or two countries is not a good thing.
Well, I know you have long argued against the U.S.'s disengagement from global affairs, and I wonder if disengagement is the right word, because from my point of view, it's not that the Trump administration is not engaging. I think it is engaging in very unorthodox ways. For example, take North Korea. We've just witnessed the first ever historic meeting between the two heads of state, but it came after, you know, essentially teetering on the brink of a war. You're a very seasoned diplomat. What do you think about this kind of approach to diplomacy?
Well, let's be honest. I think we are facing what can be one of the most important success stories in addressing a complex conflict situation. So we can criticize when we can criticize, but I must say that a recent summit that took place in Singapore is a remarkable achievement, and I congratulate the two leaders that had the courage to do it in circumstances that were complex. Of course, there were lots of episodes before, but even during these episodes, I remember very well, with the agreement of the six countries that are relevant, you know, there is the six-party talks, with the agreement of the six, I've sent my Undersecretary General on Political Affairs of the time, Jeffrey Feltman, to Pyongyang, exactly with the objective to try to prepare the conditions for this kind of dialogue to be possible, which means that even at the heat of the conflict, it was possible with the agreement of all for the UN to play a role trying to create the conditions to bring people together. That's our role.
Well, I don't know if you heard that, but Mr. Trump also suggested that he can apply this kind of personal diplomacy to Russia and, for example, ask President Putin to get out of Syria or Ukraine. I don't know about you. I would be a little bit nervous about where that conversation can lead. And I want to ask you, what do you actually think about the current state of the U.S.-Russian relations, given the presence, the very massive presence of Navy in the seas around
President Trump
Syria?
I was with President Putin recently, and I said to both the same, namely in relation to the situation in the global Middle East and in Syria, my belief, and I have said it already, that the geostrategic interests of Russia and the United States in the Middle East coincide, and that, in my opinion, it's extremely important for the future of the Middle East that the two countries come together and have a common strategy. And I think that, I mean, it is always easy, and I understand that from the point of view of the media, it's much better if you have big fights. But from the point of view of the world, it's very important that countries are able to come together, to overcome their divisions, and to understand that their common interests, especially in this world where terrorism became so dangerous, their common interests are more important than the differences that they have.
You say that Russian and American common interests in Syria overlap somehow, and there are grave doubts and grave concerns in this city that the United States may be moving towards creating some sort of a partition in Syria. I'm sure you heard John Bolton, the national security advisor to Mr. Trump, advocating the creation of the so-called Sunnistan, which would comprise certain parts of Syria and Iraq. What do you think about this idea, even if it has a chance to bring peace to that?
I recently had the opportunity to talk both with Americans and Russians on this issue, and one thing that I believe is absolutely essential is to preserve the territorial integrity of Syria, of Iraq, and other countries in the region. To try now to do some kind of new Sykes-Picot, in my opinion, would be a suicide move.
Now, there are certain issues that are absolutely central to the UN legacy. One of them is the Palestinian territories. It was the United Nations, after all, which ratified the partition of the Palestine, which allowed for the creation of Israel alongside an Arab state, the promise that was never granted. And I think that is now actively sabotaged. Do you think the Palestinians still have a reasonable hope of seeing their own state? And wouldn't it be more moral, more honest to tell them, you guys go and build your life somewhere else?
No, I don't think that is acceptable. I am a strong supporter of the two-state solution. I don't think there is
Do you think it's realistic?
I don't think there is a plan B. I think that to abandon it is not realistic, because to abandon it was to condemn that territory to a kind of confrontation in which the consequences would be absolutely devastating.
Hasn't that already happened?
Look at what happened recently in Gaza. Let's make sure that this doesn't become the situation in the whole area. A two-state solution might still be possible if we overcome the present divisions. To abandon that idea, in my opinion, is a huge risk, and I don't think that we can consider that the two-state solution should be abandoned.
Do you think the American administration, the current American administration, is serious about the two-state solution?
I'm not sure about anybody. I'm sure about what I believe. I am a strong believer that the two-state solution is essential, because a one-state solution would mean what? Would mean that everybody would have
the status quo, which has been in existence for 70 years.
This status quo, I don't think, is possible to be maintained. Never is eternal. Nothing is eternal in the world. And I believe our role is not to maintain status quo in which people suffer and in which the risks for peace and security are there at every moment. I think our role is to overcome this status quo and create a stable, peaceful solution where two peoples are able to live together in respect for their own security.
Well, Secretary General, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time today, and I invite our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.